In the city, parties begin with greetings at the door, gathered in coats, and those peculiar little air kisses. When exactly did that social oddity begin? In the country, they begin with chores. You fetch, you carry, you hunt for stuff like barbecue tongs and oven mitts. The hostess drafts a couple of men to move the picnic table, then decides it was actually better where it was and asks them to put it back. And at some point, you discover that you're having fun. I piled briquettes until they looked approximately like the pyramid on the bag, then touched a match to them. They blazed up satisfyingly, and I stood back, wiping my forearm across my forehead. Cool and clear might be coming, but it surely wasn't inhaling distance yet. The sun had burned through, and the day had gone from dull to dazzling. Yet in the west, black satin thunderheads continued to stack up. It was as if night had burst a blood vessel in the sky over there. Mike? I looked around at Kyra. What, honey? Will you take care of me? Yes, I said, with no hesitation at all. For a moment, something about my response, perhaps only the quickness of it, seemed to trouble her. Then she smiled. Okay, she said. Look, here comes the Iceman. George was back from the store. He parked and got out. I walked over with Kyra, her holding my hand and swinging it possessively back and forth. Rami came with us, juggling three heads of lettuce. I don't think he was much of a threat to the guy who had fascinated Kai on the common Saturday night. George opened the Altima's back door and brought out two bags of ice. The store was closed, he said. Sign said, we'll reopen at 5 p.m. That seemed a little too long to wait, so I took the ice and put the money through the mail slot. They'd closed for Royce Merrill's funeral, of course. Had given up almost a full day's custom at the height of the tourist season to see the old fellow into the ground. It was sort of touching. I thought it was also sort of creepy. Can I carry some ice? Kyra asked. I guess, but don't frisicate yourself, George said, and carefully put a 5-pound bag of ice into Kai's outstretched arms. Frisicate, Kyra said, giggling. She began walking toward the trailer where Maddie was just coming out. John was behind her and regarding her with the eyes of a gutshot beagle. Mommy, look, I'm frisicating. I took the other bag. I know the icebox is outside, but don't they keep a padlock on it? I am friends with most padlocks, George said. Oh, I see. Mike, catch. John tossed a red frisbee. It floated toward me, but high. I jumped for it, snagged it, and suddenly DeVore was back in my head. What's wrong with you, Roguette? You never used to throw like a girl. Get him! I looked down and saw Kai looking up. Don't think about sad stuff, she said. I smiled at her, then flipped her the frisbee. Okay, no sad stuff. Go on, sweetheart. Toss it to your mom. Let's see if you can. She smiled back, turned, and made a quick, accurate flip to her mother. The toss was so hard that Maddie almost flubbed it. Whatever else Kyra DeVore might have been, she was a frisbee champion in the making. Maddie tossed the frisbee to George, who turned, the tail of his absurd brown suit coat flaring, and caught it deftly behind his back. Maddie laughed and applauded, the hem of her top flirting with her navel. Show off, John called from the steps. Jealousy is such an ugly emotion, George said to Rami Bissonette and flipped him the frisbee. Rami floated it back to John, but it went wide and bonked off the side of the trailer. As John hurried down the steps to get it, Maddie turned to me. My boombox is on the coffee table in the living room, along with a stack of CDs. Most of them are pretty old, but at least it's music. Will you bring them out? Sure. I went inside, where it was hot in spite of three strategically placed fans working overtime. I looked at the grim, mass-produced furniture and at Maddie's rather noble effort to impart some character, the Van Gogh print that should not have looked at home in a trailer kitchenette but did, Edward Hopper's Nighthawks over the sofa, the tie-dyed curtains that would have made Joe laugh. There was a bravery here that made me feel sad for her and furious at Max DeVore all over again. Dead or not, I wanted to kick his ass. I went into the living room and saw the new Mary Higgins Clark on the sofa end table with a bookmark sticking out of it. Lying beside it in a heap were a couple of little girl hair ribbons. Something about them looked familiar to me, although I couldn't remember ever having seen Kai wearing them. I stood there a moment longer, frowning, then grabbed the boombox and CDs and went back outside. "Hey, guys," I said, "let's rock." I was okay until she danced. I don't know if it matters to you, but it does to me. I was okay until she danced. After that, I was lost. We took the Frisbee around to the rear of the house, partly so we wouldn't piss off any funeral-bound townies with our rowdiness and good cheer, mostly because Maddie's backyard was a good place to play, level ground and low grass. After a couple of missed catches, Maddie kicked off her party shoes, dashed barefoot into the house, and came back in her sneakers. After that, she was a lot better. We threw the Frisbee, yelled insults at each other, drank beer, laughed a lot. Kai wasn't much on the catching part, but she had a phenomenal arm for a kid not quite four and played with gusto. Rami had set the boombox up on the trailer's back step, and it spun out a haze of late 80s and early 90s music. U2, Tears for Fears, The Eurythmics, Crowded House, A Flock of Seagulls, Aha, The Bangles, Melissa Etheridge, Huey Lewis in the News. It seemed to me that I knew every song, every riff. We sweated and sprinted in the noon light. We watched Maddie's long, tan legs flash and listened to the bright runs of Kyra's laughter. At one point, Rami Bissonette went head over heels, all the change spilling out of his pockets, and John laughed until he had to sit down. Tears rolled from his eyes. Kai ran over and plopped on his defenseless lap. John stopped laughing in a hurry. "Oof!" he cried, looking at me with shining, wounded eyes, as his bruised balls no doubt tried to climb back inside his body. "Kyra DeVore!" Maddie cried, looking at John apprehensively. "I tackled my own quarterback," Kai said proudly. John smiled feebly at her and staggered to his feet. "Yes," he said, "you did, and the ref calls 15 yards for squashing." "Are you okay, man?" George asked. He looked concerned, but his voice was grinning. "I'm fine," John said, and spun him the Frisbee. It wobbled feebly across the yard. "Go on, throw. Let's see what you got." The thunder rumbled louder, but the black clouds were all still west of us. The sky overhead remained a harmless, humid blue. Birds still sang, and crickets hummed in the grass. There was a heat shimmer over the barbecue, and it would soon be time to slap on John's New York steaks. The Frisbee still flew, red against the green of the grass and trees, the blue of the sky. I was still in lust, but everything was still all right. Men are in lust all over the world and damn near all of the time, and the ice caps don't melt. But she danced, and everything changed. It was an old Don Henley song, one driven by a really nasty guitar riff. "Oh, God, I love this one," Maddie cried. The Frisbee came to her. She caught it, dropped it, stepped on it as if it were a hot red spot falling on a nightclub stage, and began to shake. She put her hands first behind her neck and then on her hips and then behind her back. She danced standing with the toes of her sneakers on the Frisbee. She danced without moving. She danced, as they say in that song, like a wave on the ocean. The government bugged the men's room in the local disco lounge, and all she wants to do is dance, dance, to keep the boys from selling all the weapons they can scrounge. And all she wants to do is dance. Women are sexy when they dance, incredibly sexy, but that wasn't what I reacted to or how I reacted. The lust I was coping with, but this was more than lust and not copable. It was something that sucked the wind out of me and left me feeling utterly at her mercy. In that moment, she was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen. Not a pretty woman in shorts and a midi top dancing in place on a Frisbee, but Venus revealed. She was everything I had missed during the last 4 years, when I'd been so badly off I didn't know I was missing anything. She robbed me of any last defenses I might have had. The age difference didn't matter. If I looked to people like my tongue was hanging out even when my mouth was shut, then so be it. If I lost my dignity, my pride, my sense of self, then so be it. 4 years on my own had taught me there are worse things to lose. How long did she stand there dancing? I don't know. Probably not long, not even a minute. And then she realized we were looking at her, rapt. Because to some degree, they all saw what I saw and felt what I felt. For that minute, or however long it was, I don't think any of us used much oxygen. She stepped off the frisbee, laughing and blushing at the same time, confused but not really uncomfortable. "I'm sorry," she said. I love that song." "All she wants to do is dance," Rami said. "Yes, sometimes that's all she wants," Maddie said, and blushed harder than ever. "Excuse me, I have to use the facility." She tossed me the frisbee and then dashed for the trailer. I took a deep breath, trying to steady myself back to reality, and saw John doing the same thing. George Kennedy was wearing a mildly stunned expression, as if someone had fed him a light sedative, and it was finally taking effect. Thunder rumbled. This time it did sound closer. I skimmed the frisbee to Rami. "What do you think?" "I think I'm in love," he said, and then seemed to give himself a small mental shake. It was a thing you could see in his eyes. "I also think it's time we got going on those steaks if we're going to eat outside. Want to help me?" "Sure." "I will too," John said. We walked back to the trailer, leaving George and Kyra to play toss. Kyra was asking George if he had ever caught any crinimals. In the kitchen, Maddie was standing beside the open fridge and stacking steaks on a platter. "Thank God you guys came in. I was on the point of giving in and gobbling one of these things just the way it is. They're the most beautiful things I ever saw." "You're the most beautiful thing I ever saw," John said. He was being totally sincere, but the smile she gave him was distracted and a little bemused. I made a mental note to myself. Never compliment a woman on her beauty when she has a couple of raw steaks in her hands. It just doesn't turn the windmill somehow. "How are you at barbecuing meat?" she asked me. "Tell the truth, because these are way too good to mess up." "I can hold my own." "Okay, you're hired. John, you're assisting. Rami, help me do salads." "My pleasure." George and Kai had come around to the front of the trailer and were now sitting in lawn chairs like a couple of old cronies at their London club. George was telling Kai how he had shot it out with Rolf Netto and the Real Bad Gang on Lisbon Street in 1993. "George, what's happening to your nose?" John asked. "It's getting so long." "Do you mind?" George asked. "I'm having a conversation here." "Mr. Kennedy has caught lots of crooked criminals," Kyra said. "He caught the Real Bad Gang and put them in Supermax." "Yes," I said. "Mr. Kennedy also won an Academy Award for acting in a movie called Cool Hand Luke." "That's absolutely correct," George said. He raised his right hand and crossed the two fingers. "Me and Paul Newman, just like that." "We have his Paschetti sauce," Kai said gravely, and that got John laughing again. It didn't hit me the same way, but laughter is catching. Just watching John was enough to break me up after a few seconds. We were howling like a couple of fools as we slapped the steaks on the grill. It's a wonder we didn't burn our hands off. "Why are they laughing?" Kai asked George. "Because they're foolish men with little tiny brains," George said. "Now listen, Kai. I got them all except for the human head case. He jumped into his car and I jumped into mine. The details of that chase are nothing for a little girl to hear." George regaled her with them anyway, while John and I stood grinning at each other across Maddie's barbecue. "This is great, isn't it?" John said, and I nodded. Maddie came out with corn wrapped in aluminum foil, followed by Rami, who had a large salad bowl clasped in his arms and negotiated the steps carefully, trying to peer over the top of the bowl as he made his way down them. We sat at the picnic table, George and Rami on one side, John and I flanking Maddie on the other. Kai sat at the head, perched on a stack of old magazines in a lawn chair. Maddie tied a dish towel around her neck, an indignity Kai submitted to only because A, she was wearing new clothes, and B, a dish towel wasn't a baby bib, at least technically speaking. We ate hugely. Salad, steak, and John was right, it really was the best I'd ever had. Roasted corn on the cob, strawberry snort cake for dessert. By the time we'd gotten around to the snort cake, the Thunderheads were noticeably closer, and there was a hot, jerky breeze blowing around the yard. "Maddie, if I never eat a meal as good as this one again, I won't be surprised," Rami said. "Thanks ever so much for having me." "Thank you," she said. There were tears standing in her eyes. She took my hand on one side and John's on the other. She squeezed both. "Thank you all. If you knew what things were like for Kai and me before this last week." She shook her head, gave John and me a final squeeze, and let go. "But that's over." "Look at the baby," George said, amused. Kai had slumped back in her lawn chair and was looking at us with glazing eyes. Most of her hair had come out of the scrunchie and lay in clumps against her cheeks. There was a dab of whipped cream on her nose and a single yellow kernel of corn sitting in the middle of her chin. "I threw the frisbee 6,000 times," Kyra said. She spoke in a distant, declamatory tone. "I tired." Maddie started to get up. I put my hand on her arm. "Let me?" She nodded, smiling. "If you want." I picked Kyra up and carried her around to the steps. Thunder rumbled again, a long, low roll that sounded like the snarl of a huge dog. I looked up at the encroaching clouds, and as I did, movement caught my eye. It was an old blue car heading west on Wasp Hill Road toward the lake. The only reason I noticed it was that it was wearing one of those stupid bumper stickers from the village cafe. "Horn broken, watch for finger." I carried Kai up the steps and through the door, turning her so I wouldn't bump her head. "Take care of me," she said in her sleep. There was a sadness in her voice that chilled me. It was as if she knew she was asking the impossible. "Take care of me. I'm little. Mama says I'm a little guy." "I'll take care of you," I said, and kissed that silky place between her eyes again. "Don't worry, Kai. Go to sleep." I carried her to her room and put her on her bed. By then, she was totally conked out. I wiped the cream off her nose and picked the corn kernel off her chin. I glanced at my watch and saw it was 2:50. They would be gathering at Grace Baptist by now. Bill Dean was wearing a gray tie. Buddy Jellison had a hat on. He was standing behind the church with some other men who were smoking before going inside. I turned. Maddie was in the doorway. "Mike," she said, "come here, please." I went to her. There was no cloth between her waist and my hands this time. Her skin was warm and as silky as her daughter's. She looked up at me, her lips parted. Her hips pressed forward, and when she felt what was hard down there, she pressed harder against it. "Mike," she said again. I closed my eyes. I felt like someone who has just come to the doorway of a brightly lit room full of people laughing and talking and dancing, because sometimes that is all we want to do. "I want to come in," I thought. "That's what I want to do, all I want to do. Let me do what I want. Let me..." I realized I was saying it aloud, whispering it rapidly into her ear as I held her with my hands going up and down her back, my fingertips ridging her spine, touching her shoulder blades, then coming around in front to cup her small breasts. "Yes," she said. "What we both want. Yes, that's fine." I drew back from her. Slowly, she reached up with her thumbs and wiped the wet places from under my eyes. "The key." She smiled a little. "You know where it is." "I'll come tonight." "Good." I had to clear my throat. I looked at Kyra, who was deeply asleep. "I've been lonely. I don't think I knew it, but I have been." "Me too. And I knew it for both of us. Kiss, please." I kissed her. I think our tongues touched, but I'm not sure. What I remember most clearly is the liveliness of her. She was like a dreidel lightly spinning in my arms. "Hey," John called from outside, and we sprang apart. "You guys want to give us a little help? It's going to rain." "Thanks for finally making up your mind," she said to me in a low voice. She turned and hurried back up the double wide's narrow corridor. The next time she spoke to me, I don't think she knew who she was talking to or where she was. The next time she spoke to me, she was dying. "Don't wake the baby," I heard her tell John, and his response, "Oh, sorry, sorry." I stood where I was a moment longer, getting my breath, then slipped into the bathroom and splashed cold water on my face. I remember seeing a blue plastic whale in the bathtub as I turned to take a towel off the rack. I remember thinking that it probably blew bubbles out of its spout hole, and I even remember having a momentary glimmer of an idea, a children's story about a spouting whale. Would you call him Willie? Nah, too obvious. Wilhelm, now. That had a fine, round ring to it, simultaneously grand and amusing. Wilhelm de Spouting Whale. I remember the bang of thunder from overhead. I remember how happy I was with the decision finally made and the night to look forward to. I remember the murmur of men's voices and the murmur of Maddie's response as she told them where to put the stuff. Then I heard all of them going back out again. I looked down at myself and saw a certain lump was subsiding. I remember thinking there was nothing so absurd-looking as a sexually excited man, and knew I'd had this same thought before, perhaps in a dream. I left the bathroom, checked on Kyra again, rolled over on her side, fast asleep, and then went down the hall. I had just reached the living room when gunfire erupted outside. I never confused the sound with thunder. There was a moment when my mind fumbled toward the idea of backfire, some kid's hot rod, and then I knew. Part of me had been expecting something to happen, but it had been expecting ghosts rather than gunfire. A fatal lapse. It was the rapid pa, pa, pa of an autofire weapon, a Glock 9mm as it turned out. Maddie screamed, a high, drilling scream that froze my blood. I heard John cry out in pain, and George Kennedy bellow, "Down, down, for the love of Christ, get her down." Something hit the trailer like a hard spatter of hail, a rattle of punching sounds running from west to east. Something split the air in front of my eyes. I heard it. There was an almost musical sproing sound, like a snapping guitar string. On the kitchen table, the salad bowl one of them had just brought in shattered. I ran for the door and nearly dived down the cement block steps. I saw the barbecue overturned with the glowing coals already setting patches of the scant front yard grass on fire. I saw Rami Bissonette sitting with his legs outstretched, looking stupidly down at his ankle, which was soaked with blood. Maddie was on her hands and knees by the barbecue, with her hair hanging in her face. It was as if she meant to sweep up the hot coals before they could cause some real trouble. John staggered toward me, holding out a hand. The arm above it was soaked with blood. And I saw the car I'd seen before, the nondescript sedan with the joke sticker on it. It had gone up the road, the men inside making that first pass to check us out, then turned around and come back. The shooter was still leaning out the front passenger window. I could see the stubby smoking weapon in his hands. It had a wire stock. His features were a blue blank, broken only by huge gaping eye sockets, a ski mask. Overhead, thunder gave a long, awakening roar. George Kennedy was walking toward the car, not hurrying, kicking hot spilled coals out of his way as he went, not bothering about the dark red stain that was spreading on the right thigh of his pants, reaching behind himself, not hurrying even when the shooter pulled back in and shouted, "Go, go, go," at the driver, who was also wearing a blue mask. George not hurrying, no, not hurrying a bit. And even before I saw the pistol in his hand, I knew why he had never taken off his absurd Pa Kettle suit jacket, why he had even played Frisbee in it. The blue car, it turned out to be a 1987 Ford registered to Mrs. Sonia Beliveau of Auburn and reported stolen the day before, had pulled over onto the shoulder and had never really stopped rolling. Now it accelerated, spewing dry brown dust out from under its rear tires, fishtailing, knocking Maddie's RFD box off its post and sending it flying into the road. George still didn't hurry. He brought his hands together, holding his gun with his right and steadying with his left. He squeezed off 5 deliberate shots. The first 2 went into the trunk. I saw the holes appear. The 3rd blew in the back window of the departing Ford, and I heard someone shout in pain. The 4th went I don't know where. The 5th blew the left rear tire. The Ford veered to that side. The driver almost brought it back, then lost it completely. The car plowed into the ditch 30 yards below Maddie's trailer and rolled over on its side. There was a whoomph as the rear end was engulfed in flames. One of George's shots must have hit the gas tank. The shooter began struggling to get out through the passenger window. Guy, get Guy away. A hoarse, whispering voice. Maddie was crawling toward me. One side of her head, the right side, still looked all right, but the left side was a ruin. One dazed blue eye peered out from between clumps of bloody hair. Skull fragments littered her tanned shoulder like bits of broken crockery. How I would love to tell you I don't remember any of this. How I would love to have someone else tell you that Michael Noonan died before he saw that, but I cannot. Alas is the word for it in the crossword puzzles, a 4-letter word meaning to express great sorrow. Guy. Mike. Get. Guy. I knelt and put my arms around her. She struggled against me. She was young and strong, and even with the gray matter of her brain bulging through the broken wall of her skull, she struggled against me, crying for her daughter, wanting to reach her and protect her and get her to safety. Maddie, it's all right, I said. Down at the Grace Baptist Church, at the far end of the zone I was in, they were singing Blessed Assurance, Jesus is Mine. But most of their eyes were as blank as the eye now peering at me through the tangle of bloody hair. Maddie, stop, rest, it's all right. Guy. Get Guy. Don't let them. They won't hurt her, Maddie, I promise. She slid against me, slippery as a fish, and screamed her daughter's name, holding out her bloody hands toward the trailer. The rose-colored shorts and top had gone bright red. Blood splattered the grass as she thrashed and pulled. From down the hill, there was a guttural explosion as the Ford's gas tank went. Black smoke rose toward a black sky. Thunder roared long and loud, as if the sky were saying, "You want noise? Yeah, I'll give you noise." "Say Maddie's all right, Mike," John cried in a wavering voice. "Oh, for God's sake, say she's..." He dropped on his knees beside me, his eyes rolling up until nothing showed but the whites. He reached for me, grabbed my shoulder, then tore damn near half my shirt off as he lost his battle to stay conscious and fell on his side next to Maddie. A curd of white goo bubbled from one corner of his mouth. 12 feet away, near the overturned barbecue, Rami was trying to get on his feet, his teeth clenched in pain. George was standing in the middle of Wasp Hill Road, reloading his gun from a pouch he'd apparently had in his coat pocket, and watching as the shooter worked to get clear of the overturned car before it was engulfed. The entire right leg of George's pants was red now. He may live, but he'll never wear that suit again, I thought. I held Maddie. I put my face down to hers, put my mouth to the ear that was still there, and said, "Kyra's okay. She's sleeping. She's fine, I promise." Maddie seemed to understand. She stopped straining against me and collapsed to the grass, trembling all over. Kai. Kai. This was the last of her talking on Earth. One of her hands reached out blindly, groped at a tuft of grass, and yanked it out. Over here, I heard George saying. Get over here, motherfuck, and don't you even think about turning your back on me. How bad is she? Rami asked, hobbling over. His face was as white as paper, and before I could reply, Oh, Jesus, Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Blessed be the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Oh, Mary, born without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee. Oh, no, Mike. Oh, Mike. No. He began saying the Hail Mary again, this time lapsing into Lewiston Street French, what the old folks call La Parle. Quit it, I said, and he did. It was as if he had only been waiting to be told. Go inside and check on Kyra, can you? Yes. He started toward the trailer, holding his leg and lurching along. With each lurch, he gave a high yip of pain, but somehow he kept going. I could smell burning tufts of grass. I could smell electric rain on a rising wind. And under my hands, I could feel the light spin of the dreidel slowing down as she went. I turned her over, held her in my arms, and rocked her back and forth. At Grace Baptist, the minister was now reading Psalm 139 for Royce. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light. The minister was reading, and the Martians were listening. I rocked her back and forth in my arms under the black thunderheads. I was supposed to come to her tonight, use the key under the pot, and come to her. She had danced with the toes of her white sneakers on the red frisbee, had danced like a wave on the ocean, and now she was dying in my arms while the grass burned in little clumps, and the man who had fancied her as much as I had lay unconscious beside her, his left arm painted red from the short sleeve of his We Are the Champions t-shirt all the way down to his bony, freckled wrist. Maddie, I said. Maddie, Maddie, Maddie. I rocked her and smoothed my hand across her forehead, which on the right side was miraculously unsplattered by the blood that had drenched her. Her hair fell over the ruined left side of her face. Maddie, I said. Maddie, Maddie. Oh, Maddie. Lightning flashed, the first stroke I had seen. It lit the western sky in a bright blue arc. Maddie trembled strongly in my arms. All the way from neck to toes she trembled, her lips pressed together, her brow furrowed as if in concentration. Her hand came up and seemed to grab for the back of my neck, as a person falling from a cliff may grasp blindly at anything to hold on just a little longer. Then it fell away and lay limply on the grass, palm up. She trembled once more. The whole delicate weight of her trembled in my arms. And then she was still.